Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Up to Date, a podcast on developments in property law brought to you by the junior barristers at Tanfield Chambers. Each week, we look to summarise the developments in the property law market and the functionings of the Court and Tribunal Service, as well as talk you through developments in recent cases. I'm Richard Granby, and this week, I'm joined by Will Beatson. We aim to keep you up to date with key aspects of a changing landscape, so that you will be up to date. Hello, Will.
Hello, Richard.
The property law news we're talking about this week is the government's confirmation at the beginning of the month that possession claims would resume being processed from the 23rd of August. And certainly in all courts, possession claims seem to be being listed for shortly that date. So, Will, how do you think the system's going to get up and running again?
Well, for me, Richard, the crucial word here is the use of the word processing. On that basis, I think it's unlikely that we will see the immediate resumption of the hearing of possession claims on the 23rd of August, or perhaps the next couple of days afterwards. When we finally do see the return of possession hearings, which will be welcome news to some, if not all, I think it will look very different to how things looked pre-lockdown. While there have been discussions about the increased use of court buildings, using more courtrooms, and increased use of deputy district judges, I think it's nevertheless going to be a very difficult task clearing the backlog that has arisen as a consequence of lockdown. I think we will see very frequent adjournments, not only because defendants will doubtless email into court and seek an adjournment on the basis that they've been affected by the coronavirus, that they are either ill themselves, that they are shielding, or that a family member is ill, for example. And I'm of the view that those adjournments are likely to be readily granted. Also, we're very unlikely to see a return of the good old Central London County Court mosh pit, where one would see perhaps 30 to 40 possession claims listed in one day on the same floor. That simply isn't compatible with the requirements of social distancing. So the process is likely, in my view, to be slow and painful. And of course, while deputy district judges will endeavour to clear the backlog with the best one in the world, many of them will be less familiar with dealing with possession claims, perhaps listed for 5 or 10 minutes. And that is another reason why I think it will take a very long time to clear the backlog. I think it's going to be a very long time before we see the capacity of the courts to deal with such claims returned to normality. And this will, of course, cause a lot of frustration to landlords who have been waiting patiently to get a possession order against their tenants, many of whom, of course, will not have been paying the rent, often for very understandable reasons. But that isn't necessarily the test, as it were. It's going to be a very frustrating time for many. What do you think, Richard?
Yes, the return to packing in 40 or 50 people into a small waiting room in the Thomas More building, while on some levels that's welcome, is going to slow down the clearing of the backlog, simply because that was the most efficient way for the court to list those cases. And some courts will be physically capable of maintaining social distancing with fairly busy lists. Some simply won't. Another fact we've seen recently, a colleague in Chambers, is that with the development of track and trace, if a court user is struck with coronavirus, it is possible the court may close on short notice. So hearings cannot be guaranteed to go ahead simply because they're listed. Now, in one sense, that was always true, but that's going to be particularly acute. The court's attempt to resume possession hearings, if they're dealt with remotely, and the mood music, as some of them will be dealt with remotely. I think the experience of almost everyone practicing in this area has been that those hearings deal with, and also require a good deal more preparation, increase of cost. So for all those reasons, I don't see us going back to the old days particularly quickly, or indeed perhaps at all.
So while there is light at the end of the tunnel for landlords, we are simply going to have to wait and see how this will play out. But I'm certainly of the view that more patience, certainly on the part of landlords, will be required.
Yes, one consequence of this is that when the separate set of restrictions on forfeiture in the Coronavirus Act expire, we might see an increased willingness by landlords whose tenants have run up rent arrears and who aren't prepared to grant a degree of forbearance, an increased willingness by those landlords to effect re-entry in cases where the lease allows them to do so. Now, obviously, that can only apply to commercial premises, and residential landlords would be exposing themselves to a tremendous degree of risk if they were to go and attempt that, in part because it's a crime, in part because it's usually also an express breach of the terms of the tenancy. But I do wonder if we will see an increase both in legitimate but perfectly robust attempts at re-entry in commercial premises, and perhaps as patience wears thin or mortgage holidays expire, an increased willingness to take chances in the residential sector as well.
Well, let's hope we don't see that, but as a loyal listener of the podcast, as you rightly pointed out in the last edition, even if a right of forfeiture were exercised by a commercial landlord, it begs the question as to whether they will be able to find a viable replacement tenant. So the situation remains very uncertain, very volatile, and we can but wait.
The three cases we're talking about this week are decision of the Court of Appeal in TFS Stores Limited and the Design Retail Outlet Centres, an upper tribunal decision called Shepherd, MGH Limited and Turner, and another upper tribunal decision called AA Homes and Housing Limited and Croydon LBC. So the first case we have to talk about is TFS Stores Limited. This is, at least in my view, a fairly transparent policy decision by the Court of Appeal to consider all proceedings to be pursuant to Part 55, whether or not any of the parties ever realised Part 55 was engaged at all, or indeed whether or not the claims actually featured a claim for possession at all. That said, Will has always liked to think of himself as a dissenter. So, Will, what do you have to say about this?
Well, it's an interesting one in that both the relevant claims started life as claims for declarations. The landlord in one of the claims counterclaimed in possession. So the question was whether the stay applied to counterclaims, i.e. were they brought under Part 55. Second claim was for a declaration only. And the logical outcome, or the only legal outcome of the judge's decision in that particular matter, was that a possession order should be made because the judge held that the tenant did not enjoy 1954 protection. So, in the second claim, a possession order was made by consent. At no point was possession pleaded in the originating process. At no point was the Part 55 procedure followed. Nevertheless, Lord Justice Voss held with the majority. He was joined by Lady Justice Aspin, that Part 55 nevertheless applied to both claims, and therefore the stay applied to both claims. To me, this
yes,
is odd
indeed.
because the stay specifically says that it applies to claims brought under Part 55. I personally struggle to see in what sense either claims could have been brought under Part 55, but it's pretty clear why the Court of Appeal has done this, even though it may not seem the most legally defensible decision. What do you think, Richard?
I agree. It's never a good sign when the court has to resort to the glossary of the civil procedure rules to define the words proceedings. But the clear policy decision is that if something in there can result in a claim for possession, then the stay under originally the practice direction and now 55.29 will apply, and that the stay will also not be lifted even if there's no prospect of enforcement during the prescribed period. So if a claim for possession is a consequence of your claim, then you're going to have to wait until after the 23rd of August, including for the hearing of any related appeals.
Yeah, it seems to take away the point is that if at any point possession comes into a set of proceedings, then it is caught by 55.29. Odd, but there we go.
So the second case we have to talk about is Shepherd and Martin Grant Holmes. This was a case under a little used provision, providing for the original beneficiary of a restrictive covenant or a grantor of the covenant to receive compensation under section 8412 of the Law of Property Act 1925, where a tenant applies successfully for release. The facts of Shepherd are perfectly straightforward. Mr. Shepherd owned a detached house and he wished to build a semi-detached house on top of his garage and part of his garden. By the time the matter reached trial, there was no serious objection to the release. The sole dispute, sole substantive dispute, was over compensation. Martin Grant Holmes had a diligent and fairly convoluted expert report that helped them make submissions that the appropriate level of compensation was between £20,000 and £30,000. Mr. Shepherd had a long-standing offer of £4,000 that reflected simply what he thought was fair. And the way in which the Upper Tribunal resolved the case in Shepherd was, in effect, to be very critical of the way in which Martin Grant Holmes had proceeded in the litigation, to take a rough and ready view of how much more a customer might have been willing to pay for the house without the restriction, and then to refuse to uplift it for inflation, in part because Martin Grant Holmes hadn't engaged in alternative dispute resolution. So, Will, is there more to this case than a judge's annoyance with Martin Grant Holmes?
Well, it discloses two things. I mean, not really, Rich, it is the answer, but it discloses two things. One, there is no binding authority on whether the Upper Tribunal should apply inflation to cases such as these, and if so, by what metric? And secondly, the most important point is it discloses the importance of engaging in ADR. The tribunal judge was deeply unhappy that the objector, the respondent in this matter, had refused to engage in it. And quite frankly, I think his approach to the case reflected that, and that is the animus behind his decision. He formed the view that you've had an offer on the table of £4,000 for quite some time. You've made no sensible efforts to resolve this by the means, so that's what you get. So for practitioners listening out there, I would emphasize again, even if you don't think it'll be productive, you've got to have a go at ADR, simply so that you can say you have, in some cases. Would you agree?
Yes, it's striking that the applicant was able to succeed on his valuation despite not calling any evidence whatsoever in support of it, and despite any inflation uplift on the judge's award would in fact have exceeded the valuation figure sought by the objector. So it's hard to see this as anything more than a serious chastisement of Martin Grant Holmes for their approach to the litigation and to negotiations. The final case we have for listeners who've stayed with us this far is AA Homes and Housing Limited against Croydon London Borough Council, again in the upper tribunal. The facts shortly stated are that a fine was imposed on AA Homes for failure to license due to the local authority's power under the Housing Act 2004. The local authority had a policy that they followed, and that the first tier tribunal was also obliged to broadly follow on a rehearing before the tribunal. That policy required regard to be had to the level of harm caused by the particular offence. And what the upper tribunal said is that both Croydon and the first tier tribunal had gone wrong in considering it relevant to the harm caused by the failure to license the landlord's other breaches, in particular breaches of the Fire Safety Order 2005. And it has to be said what appear to be particularly serious breaches of the Fire Safety Order 2005. Will, where does this decision leave us?
The decision leaves us with the important distinction between harm and an aggravating factor. There was no causal link between the harm caused by the failure to license and the breaches of fire safety. In a sense, it was the upper tribunal applying strict logic to the problem and drawing an important semantic distinction, as I've said, between an aggravating factor and causal harm. I suspect when this decision is remitted to the FTT, or it has been, but when it's heard, that everything will come out rather similarly to how it did in the first place, i.e. a hefty fine being imposed. The only difference is the different route which is used to arrive at that conclusion. The proper weight to be given to the failure to for the failure to properly abide by fire safety regulations lies as an aggravating factor, not as part of a harm analysis. I would say that is the takeaway point in this case.
Yes, we should add in fairness to the parties that there were fact-specific points in relation to the second defend as a second defendant that may not have rendered the appeal academic. But I share your suspicion that when the tribunal reconsiders this, they may simply move elements of the monetary award from one column to another and produce a very similar figure at the end of it. They just have to be they have to be careful, and Croydon has to be careful applying these policies to make sure that the correct process is followed.
And also, what I would say finally is that it's very apparent that both the FTT and the Upper Tribunal was irritated by the defaulting party's failure to give any oral evidence or submit a proper witness statement within the proceedings, and that documents were handed up piecemeal during the hearing. So, quite simply, contrition is better than silence in matters such as these.
Yes, if you're going to plead that you've changed your ways, then you need to put in proper evidence, and it never hurts to show either the local authority or the tribunal some respect in the process. That seems like a helpful takeaway point for our listeners who've stayed with us to the end of the programme. So I'd like to thank people for listening, and the cases we covered this week were AA Homes and London Borough of Croydon, Shepherd and Martin Grant Homes again in the Upper Tribunal, stores and the designer retail outlet centres. The full references will be in the description to this podcast. Thank you very much for listening.